Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Charlie Marshall. He is the owner and chef of The Marshall, a wonderful snail of approval restaurant up in Hell's Kitchen. And he's also set to open a new restaurant, and he'll be coming on in just a little bit, and he'll tell us more about The Marshall and the new opening of his next restaurant in just a little bit. But before he comes on, I want to tell you about some things going on in and around the city, share with you some things going on in the news, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. Great things going on. This weekend, on Sunday, Slow Food North Shore is having their summer solstice celebration right here at the IE Green Homestead. If you're interested in joining us, you can go on to the IE Green website at iegreen.com or slowfoodnorthshore.org and register to come, RSVP, and you'll get directions to the homestead. It is a potluck. We have great live music coming. Some of the best musicians around will be here rocking it out, and there will be volleyball and swimming, and it's just a way to celebrate the summer. It's the beginning of beautiful weather, of people being outdoors in the sunshine and coming together. And so it's just always nice to connect with a community of people that care about their food, care about the planet, and for us all to meet each other because we need to stick together. So if you are around on Sunday in the evening starting at 5, come out for the Slow Food North Shore Summer Solstice Celebration. Earlier in the day, same day, June 26th, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, will be hosting, along with a master herbalist, Eugene Zambirian, who's a natural doctor, a medicinal and edible herb walk out at Restoration Farm. Restoration Farm is a beautiful farm on the property of the old Bethpage Village. It's a wonderful organic farm and CSA. They have chickens, eggs as well. Really a great place, but you'll be walking the fields with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Eugene Zambirian and pointing out the different medicinal and edible plants that are there, and then you'll actually be bringing them back and creating some herb salves and cough medicines and tinctures from the different edibles that you collect. So if you're interested in that, go on to the Natural Nurse's website, Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. Check that out. June 28th, connecting the dots between our health, our environment, and the foods we eat with Junie Moon. That is a podcast TV show that I will be a guest on. That will be next Tuesday, June 28th. It will be 6 to 9 Eastern Standard Time. That doesn't make sense. It's 1 hour. But anyway, if you register, I will have a link that I'll be sending out to register, or you can go to Junie Moon's website and register. You'll get a link to participate in that podcast. July 8th through the 17th, the Long Island Food Truck Rodeo is going on out at the Southampton Elks Lodge. That's fun. It's 10 days of food and fun, entertainment, local beer and wine, craft vendors, farmers markets, etc. Should be fun if you're out in the Hampton area. Check that out. It's in Southampton. July 18th, the Long Island Food Coalition, along with Slow Food North Shore, are sponsoring a trip out to the Rodale Institute. The Rodale Institute is in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. It's an independent agricultural research center committed to organic practices. We have rented a luxury bus that will be taking you there. There will be lunch, and we'll be doing, in addition to the tour, a two-hour organic agricultural workshop. So hope you can make that. July 23rd is a farm-to-table benefit dinner for the Sylvia Center, which is a learning center down on the Lower East Side. Great, great center, really connecting with a lot of the local kids who really need to learn about where their food comes from. And the Sylvia Center owns Catchkey Farm up in Kinderhook, New York. And that's where this farm-to-table benefit dinner will take place. So you can go to the Sylvia Center's website to find out more about that. Okay, I want to share a recipe with you now. This is a mint, feta, and watermelon salad. I believe I've shared this before, but I had a request for it, so I thought I would share it again. It comes together so easy, so quickly, and it's just so good. So you're going to start with one seedless watermelon, a third cup of white balsamic vinegar. Now, you can get a white balsamic vinegar at Trader Joe's. Whole Foods carries one as well. You don't want to use regular balsamic just because of the color it makes the watermelon. It just really discolors the watermelon in not such a pretty way. So try to find white balsamic vinegar if you can. Juice of 1/2 lemon, 2 tablespoons olive oil, salt and pepper to taste, 1 red onion chopped. And depending on the size of the onion, you can always add more, but it's easy to overdo it, so go light on the red onion. 1 pound of feta cheese cut into small cubes, and 1 medium bunch of mint leaves chopped. So you're going to first cut the watermelon into 1-inch cubes and then let that drain out in a colander for about a half an hour. Put a bowl underneath, and, of course, you can save that watermelon juice and drink it. It's absolutely delicious. But let it drain for at least a half an hour to get some of that juice out. Then you're going to whisk together the white balsamic vinegar, the olive oil, and the lemon juice in a small bowl. And then you're going to pour that over the watermelon, the feta cheese, and the onion, and the mint. Mix that together in a large bowl. And, mix all the things together, the watermelon, the feta, the onion, and the mint in a large bowl first, and refrigerate that. And don't put the dressing on until right before serving. And then you can sprinkle it with salt and pepper. And that is it. Super easy, super delicious, and beautiful. So you can find that recipe on my website if you didn't just write it down. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you Charlie Marshall. Charlie grew up on his family farm, and they also had a restaurant on Lummi Island in Washington State. And he worked at the family restaurant since he was 12, a career path that he has stuck with. His parents used many ingredients from their own family farm, and he didn't realize until he got older how unusual and lucky he was about that. And when it came time to open his own restaurant, he really wanted to emulate that that experience that he had growing up. He's actually scheduled to open a new restaurant, Diane Elizabeth's. Well, when did you become a Snail of Approval restaurant?
As quickly as possible. They make you be open for a year before they'll even come in and consider you as a Snail of Approval restaurant, I think mostly because they want to make sure that you have learned to do things the way that one needs to do them in order to be a Snail of Approval restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
We're also a member of the Green Restaurant Association. We have 3 stars, which very few restaurants in New York have 3 stars from the Green Restaurant Association. Having that Snail of Approval is a really big deal to us, and the diners who know what it means when they see it in our window, it means a lot to them as well. We're very proud
of
it.
Well, that's how I found you. I mean, I know when I go out to eat in the city, I look at the Green Restaurant Association or the Snail of Approval to find the restaurants that I want to support. And so it is a great honor. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So what makes the Marshall sustainable and green restaurant? What do you do that makes you special?
Well, lots of things. First of all, I always like to say we don't burn dinosaurs. So we do not burn any gas, we cook everything with fruit wood, which is replanted. It's from local orchards, so we use apple wood and cherry wood. We also buy wind power, which anyone who has a Con Edison account can do for their own home or for their business, and I'm sure some of our ions are probably coming from Indian Point, but we're paying to have some wind power put into the grid and to take it out again. And additionally, all of our wines and spirits are local. Our wine is actually all from New York State. Besides supporting local wineries and the families that run them, it also reduces carbon. You can imagine bringing wine from upstate New York or from the North Fork or South Fork requires a lot less carbon than perhaps shipping wine from Italy or Southern California or South America. And then we support local farms as well. 99% of what goes on a plate at the Marshall is locally sourced. That's from our grapeseed oil that we cook with, all the way to our vegetables and our meats, which are humanely raised. So we really try to do some, you know, do everything in a way that, you know, we can sleep at night and feel good about the way that we do things.
And how do you manage that in the winter?
We're very lucky in that the farmers, well, first of all, you know, New York has subsidized, the state itself has subsidized greenhouse growing in an effort to make year-round farming more affordable for farmers. So you can imagine greenhouses are very expensive not only to construct but also to heat, and they've come in very handy also in the spring. It means earlier crops because the farmers can get their started earlier than if they were doing everything outside, and also, you know, allows them to grow some crops through the winter. But mainly we rely on stored crops. That would be apples, potatoes, turnips, parsnips, rutabaga, things like this that last, you know, through the winter. And so when you look at our menu in the winter, it is very wintry feeling. But luckily, I think in the winter, you know, that's kind of the food we crave. We want starch and meat and cheese and, you know, apples and the heavier root stock kind of stuff that you want to eat. And in the spring, we really want, you know, snap peas and strawberries. And in the summer, we want corn. And so luckily, our tastes change with the season. Otherwise, the Marshall would be pretty empty in December.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what made you venture to New York after growing up on the West Coast, you know, the Northern West Coast, in a state like Washington?
Well,
what made you want to venture into
New York State?
New York City?
You know, I think that, you know, anyone who grows up in a local food movement, wherever they go, when they take that with them. And if I moved to Hawaii, I'd be hopefully living on pineapples and sugar cane. But when it's the way you do things, it's just the way you do things. I wish I had a romantic, wonderful answer for the reason that I moved to New York, but I don't. 1% of Lummi Island, that's six of us, graduated from college around the same time, and we all were looking for an adventure, and we all moved here kind of as a support group together. It was actually a wonderful way to move to the city.
And, oh, nice.
Yeah, so three of us are still out here in our later adulthood, and three of us have either moved back to the island or other areas back on the West Coast. But I love New York. It's really been a privilege to be here, and you know, we have very educated diners, and it's a great dining scene, and I feel like we've made a big difference in the way that things are done. And, you know, we were the first, you know, when we first opened the Marshall, was told, you know, oh, you serve pizza? Because we were using a wood oven. Everybody thought we were a pizza place. And now, 3 years later, there are many American-style or continental-style wood oven restaurants. And I think we started a very sustainable trend that I hope will continue. We like the competition, and it's a much better way of doing business.
Absolutely. So you do eat meat. And I know, you know, at the Marshall, you know, it's not a plant-based restaurant.
No.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your philosophy on procuring meat and, you know, what makes meat sustainably produced in your mind?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I enjoy eating meat. I myself don't eat a ton of meat, but I do serve a lot of meat. Most of our entrees are either fish or meat-based. We have a large farm side section that has one meat item, which is our veal meatballs, which is a humanely raised veal. But to me, you know, there are obviously, you know, factory farm commodity-type practices that are used to raise the majority of meat that hits our system. And if you go somewhere and order a steak, you know, there's absolutely zero chance that you're getting your meat from somewhere like Arcadian Pastures, where we source a lot of our meat from, or Wall Farms, family farm upstate. You are getting commodity beef or commodity pork. And aside from the sustainability issues, you know, it's also an issue of what these animals are being fed and what they're being treated with. A lot of people may have heard that, you know, just recently the FDA outlawed a couple of different antibiotics that were being used on commodity pork for decades because they were found to be so systemic that they were staying in the pork and making it to humans, and they were incredibly carcinogenic. They were worried that they've been giving people cancer with hot dogs and mm-hmm. whatever else this, you know, pork was ending up in. So we work very hard to source our meat from local farms. I mentioned Arcadian Pastures and Wall Farms. They're two of our main farms that supply us with both beef and pork. And Laurent, who started Arcadian Pastures with his wife, they started farming meat because his wife was diagnosed with cancer. And they couldn't understand how this happened, and they believed it was partly their diet, and they liked eating meat, but they didn't believe in the chain, and they wanted to have control over it. And so they started Arcadian Pastures, where they raise chicken, pork, beef, and lamb. And they do so humanely, and they do so in small numbers, and they do so with a hands-on management, and they do the butchering themselves. And so it's a chain that if you can trust the person, you can trust the meat. And keeping things small like that, to me, is a way that you can be much more sustainable. These people are not, you know, bringing in tractor trailers to remove the animal refuse and go, you know, pump it onto a field somewhere, et cetera, et cetera. So their kinds of practices are much cleaner, much more sustainable. They're worried about, you know, polluting and keeping their own farm clean because it's their land. And when you have farmers that have that sort of self-interest, you end up with a much cleaner product. Also, they don't use, you know, antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera. I know that Laurent does occasionally get a sick animal. He'll, you know, give them antibiotics just like you or I would take antibiotics if we were sick, but they're not prophylactically injecting their animals in order to make them gain weight like commodity producers do.
Yeah. One thing that makes me crazy about the organic labeling is that in order to be labeled organic, you're not allowed to treat a sick animal with an antibiotic and then, you know, separate them and return them back to the flock.
Correct.
That doesn't seem humane to me.
It doesn't. You should be able to treat them. I do believe that, you know, if you know, what most farmers do too, because an animal is a valuable investment. I mean, they're not either you're buying a young animal or it's being birthed on your farm. But either way, just the investment in the feed it consumes. I do believe that most organic farmers, if they've got an animal that can be cured with antibiotics, they most likely sell it to somebody that can treat it and raise it on an organic way. But certainly, yeah, you know, organic farmers, to me, have great care, and they want to do the right thing, and they're not certainly letting animals die in the name of organic, but it does remove it from the organic label chain. And at the Marshall, you know, not all our farmers are organic. Some are, they call it, you know, organic method. Some are organic. Some refuse to participate.
That's what I mean. It's like, you know, if you say you trust the farmer, if you know the farmer, you know they're doing it the right way, but they want to have the ability to treat a sick animal and make it better and then let it, you know, continue on.
Exactly, but you can't call that one organic.
Exactly.
And really it can't
be
on your land because it's byproducts, it's waste, are not organic, and, you know, they don't use a toilet, so... once they've been treated, they have to move elsewhere. Everything's not organic. You know, people want a very pure label, and, you know, organic isn't quite as pure as it used to be, but it is a pretty good, you know, indicator of how things are either raised or grown. And it's important, you know, there will be many attempts to continue to dilute the meaning of organic. And it's really important that people stand up and say no to that, because that's the only definition we have now to be able to go to the grocery store and say, hey, is this covered in pesticides? Hey, is this GMO? You know, and there will be many, many attempts because that's a very valuable label, and it has attracts a lot of sales, and a lot of large companies will try to change what that word means, and they can do it. So hopefully people will stand up and keep that from happening.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, our government, it's just so weird how they do things. Like, you know, you're talking about removing that antibiotic. You know, it's like in our world here, unlike the EU, our government approves things, and then it's up to the consumer to petition and to rally and to prove that it's unsafe to try to get it removed, as opposed to doing proper testing beforehand before adding anything.
Correct. Or they may not approve it and just let it fly, you know.
Right.
As we've seen with the new GMO regulations, you know, okay, well, just you're not liable for any damage and that you cause people, and you don't have to test it, and you can release it to the environment, and that's all fine now. You know, now that's all okay.
Right.
And
then they removed the labeling of origin for the meat.
Yeah.
You know, where the meat comes from. So, you know, you used to be able to, for years you didn't, and we finally, through petitions, got them to add the place of origin down onto the meat, and then the meat lobbyists just got it removed.
Yep, it was just removed. And, you know, thank you, NAFTA. And, you know, that's one of the byproducts of trade agreements. And, you know, for instance, if TPP gets passed, you know, then we're going to have a lot more things like that, except that then the meat producers will also be able to sue our government and collect $250 million for no reason or, you know, who knows.
It's
a weird system, and it's people have to stay awake and protect our interests. You know, everybody has to participate in a republic.
Absolutely. So how did growing up on a tiny island in Washington State affect the way you do business and the way that you like to eat?
Sure. Well, you know, when you eat off your family farm, things taste different. They taste much like they do at the Marshall. I always like to say that we cheat at the Marshall because the ingredients taste so much better than what our competitors are buying, you know, off the commodity market, that we have to do much less adulteration. We have to add much less fat. We have to add fewer spices. We have to do much less work to make things taste good because things, when they're fresh, have such a better flavor and such a richer, the sugar snap peas, that it's almost, you know, someone who's never had a fresh sugar snap pea is like, wow, these are like peas on steroids. No, those are peas.
Right.
That's how they're supposed to taste.
Uh-huh.
And so when I went to school in Iowa, which is, you know, the heart of commodity, you know,
farmland
agriculture. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I was so frustrated with the way that food tasted when I was, and everybody thought I was just nuts. I was, God, this tastes horrible. I don't like this. And this got no flavor, and blah, blah, blah. And that's how I felt almost every time I ate there for 4 years. And I would go home and have the food. It was just so amazing. And I was also eating in a college cafeteria, you know, which is probably not, you know, the highest.
The best either.
Yeah, the best sourcing. I'm sure they source better now, but. It affected my palate. Living on a small island on a farm, where you're eating your food and your neighbor's food, and we certainly went to the grocery store like everybody else, but our grocery store was further away. I mean, we had to take a ferry and then drive, you know, 20 miles to get to town and then buy your groceries and then haul them all the way back. And so my mother and father really encouraged us. So my first business when I was a kid was raising eggs, and I had, you know, most kids had a paper route, and I had an egg route, and I would get in trouble with the mail lady for putting my eggs in people's mailboxes, but I would deliver my eggs to our neighbors. And And then as we got older, we started illegally making ice cream in our house out of our neighbor's illegal unpasteurized cream. And I can tell you that because she's since passed away. But we would sell it at the ferry dock, you know, a captive audience. And so I learned very quickly at a young age that people wanted good, traceable food, even if it was ice cream made by 8-year-olds, or eggs delivered to somebody's mailbox by their neighbor, and that really stuck with me. And then I think, lastly, growing up on an island of 600 people, and I encourage anyone that's ever in the Pacific Northwest to go to the Willows Inn, which is a wonderful restaurant, James Beard awarded restaurant on Mummy Island. Make reservations way ahead of time. But growing up on an island of 600 people, you learn a sense of neighborliness in the way that you do business. And I mean, my parents still have their farm. They have a vegetable stand that, it's an honor can. And they put their lettuce out there, and they put their eggs out there, and people come and put money in the coffee can, and they write IOUs on sticky notes, or there's not change in the can, they write "you owe me." And doing business like that in a colloquial, local kind of way is the way that I like to do business. And it's also the way I like to manage my employees. And I think it makes for a happier customer, it makes for a better product, and it makes for happier, happier staff.
Happy all the way around.
Yeah.
We all crave neighborliness.
Yeah.
It's like I'm actually having a neighbor party this evening at my place because I've been here 16 years now, and when I first moved in, I didn't know anyone, so I had a block party then so I could meet everybody because I knew they weren't going to come and meet me.
Okay.
And now there's been a changeover on the block. I don't know anybody anymore, so I invited everybody over just because where I live, everybody's in their own little cocoon, and you don't know people. I mean, a lot of people even have gates around their property, so it doesn't, it's anything but. And I remember when I lived in New York being so surprised at how neighborly, believe it or not, my little neighborhood on the Upper East Side felt. After you're in a place for a while and you start, you do business with the same regular people. If I didn't have money, they'd say, "Oh, come back tomorrow." The same thing you say, a sticky note.
I mean,
even in New York City, you can create that neighborly feeling, and it's just, it comes from the heart.
Yeah, and I think one of the wonderful parts of Hell's Kitchen is it's, even though it's, we're two blocks, large avenue blocks from Times Square. It's one of the more undeveloped parts of Manhattan. That's changing very quickly. We all see these giant, condominiums going in, et cetera, which have actually brought some of our nicest customers to the neighborhood. But it is a change from, the brownstones on the side streets and the five-story walk-ups on the avenues to these, 40 and 60-foot towers. Or 40 to 60 story towers, pardon me. But because of this, you have these people that have been in the neighborhood 20, 30, 40 years, and they're wonderful. And I mean, I know people in the neighborhood just from walking by and saying hello and petting their dog or whatever, that have never been to my restaurant. I've got to come in. They've never come, but we say hi every day on the street. And that is something that I've always cherished, and I think that maybe some people don't get it. It's not something that everybody craves, but it's something that I appreciate, and it's part of my business practice that I cherish. And I think that
I'm with you on that. I think it's so important, and it just I also think you can taste that love in the food.
And you can. And the same thing happens, when you go to the farmer's market. If you have a farmer's market that you go to, you start to get to know your farmers. You start to get to know what they have. You start to get to know their process. When your dairy guy is making a particular cheese, or how long it takes. I mean, he'll tell you what he does. You start to understand. It's funny because the seasons here are different than in Washington State. Things here are sometimes later or sometimes earlier. So I'll be on the phone with my parents talking to them about what's going on. My dad has tomatoes right now. Right now we can only get hot house tomatoes at the farmer's market. That'll change relatively quickly. But his tomatoes are ready already over in Washington. So it's you get that same feeling of community and oneness with the farmer. And you get to the point where somebody says, "Oh, how do you know this is such and such?" You almost become incredulous. Well, this is, this is Bonnie's. Of course it's perfect. She made it. She raised it herself. I know this is good. It's something that you can, I encourage people, if they don't already, probably most of your listeners already go to a farmer's market regularly, but it's is something that I have to do four times a week down in Union Square. And over 3 years, we've developed some amazing relationships. And the farmers will do special stuff for you when you're nice to them, FYI.
Right, right, absolutely. So can you share with us what's your new favorite recipe for the summer?
Well, I was laughing to myself because you stole it with your watermelon salad. I just made a wonderful watermelon salad the other day. Yours sounds better though. I use cherries in mine, mostly because they're around right now, and I absolutely love cherries. Or you can use whatever you want. Everything goes with watermelon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're about to do one of my favorite recipes that rolls around every summer, and you can do it in your oven. I love peaches, and the peaches in New York are just, phenomenal. So we just got peaches in yesterday, and we're going to be doing a roasted peach half. So I cut a
roasted peach half.
Yes, I take a... basically cut a peach along the line all the way around, remove the pit, press a little bit of brown sugar, or if you're a real purist, you can use sorghum, which is a really nice local sugar made from sorghum, which is related to corn, or you can use maple sugar. You press about 2 tablespoons into the half, it's a large half, or 1 tablespoon if it's a smaller half, a little bit of blue cheese on top of that, and then some walnuts, and you roast it in your oven until it's warmed through. So if you did that in 350 degree oven, it'd probably be about 15 minutes, and serve. And they're absolutely delicious. You can serve that for dessert. You can serve it as a side to some roasted pork if you're a meat eater, or roasted whatever if you're not. But that's a really fun and simple, four ingredient dish that I love, and it sells like hotcakes at the Marshall. You can imagine, obviously, in our wood oven at 600 degrees, we're not leaving it in there, for 15 minutes. It's about 3 minutes.
Sounds incredible.
It is, and it's super simple and really good.
Now
and
you got local peaches already, huh?
Yeah.
Mine are not ready yet. Mine are still, they're a little bit bigger. They're bigger than a quarter now. I guess maybe they're like the size of a silver dollar. But
well, it's funny, with all of our fruits, every year they start south and go north. So, for instance, strawberries, my first strawberries came from Phillips Farm, and they're relatively South Jersey. And then we'll still be getting strawberries probably, even a month and a half, 2 months from now from Buried Treasures Farm up in Roscoe, New York. She's pretty far up. She's cooler than everybody else. She does these little hybrid French strawberries that are just, you touch them and they just vaporize into juice. They're wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same thing will happen with the peaches as well.
Right. Let's take a couple minute break. When we come back, I want you to tell us a little bit about your new venture, Diane and Elizabeth. Set to open later this summer?
Yes, it is.
Woohoo! Great.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Charlie Marshall, owner and chef of The Marshall, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest today, Charlie Marshall, owner and chef of The Marshall. And he's going to come on in just a second, but I forgot to mention something at the very beginning of my show that I just want to ask all of you to do. To go onto my website at IE Green, I have two petitions up there. One is to tell the Senate that we want to strengthen our personal care safety laws. It's really important. People don't think about what's in our personal care products, and this time of year, especially when everyone's blobbing on that sunscreen, you really want to know that there's different types of sunscreen. There's sunscreen that's carcinogenic, and there's sunscreen that isn't. And so this petition would help the Senate to push through a law that would require labeling. But in the meantime, until that happens also, go to the Environmental Working Group website, ewg.org. They have a great list there of personal care products, and they rate sunscreens, and it's really a great list. So I just wanted to share that with all of you this time of year. It's really, really important. And then there's also a petition to help defend the Vermont GMO labeling law, which, of course, Monsanto and the Grocery Manufacturers Association is spending millions of dollars to try to defeat as it gets closer and closer to becoming a law. So check those out on my website. And now, again, it's my pleasure to introduce Charlie Marshall to all of you. Charlie, you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. So tell us about the new restaurant, where it is, and what philosophy that has, how is it going to be different from the Marshall, et cetera.
Absolutely. Diane Elizabeth is one block north of the Marshall. As a small business owner, it is a little difficult to make ends meet, and most restaurateurs, from Momofuku to our neighboring restaurants, if they're going to be successful, you really, for the scale of economy, you need to have more than one place. We're a fair wage employer. We have 22 employees at the Marshall, and we've just felt that in order to be efficient, we needed to be bigger and have a second place that didn't require 22 employees, et cetera, et cetera. So that all happens when you're able to, share the prep that you're doing with one restaurant with another, and get better prices from some farmers because you're ordering more
buying
items.
Scale.
From them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. So Diane Elizabeth is a wine bar and kitchen. It's about twice the size of the Marshall. It almost looks like the Marshall twin as far as the floor plan, but just twice and then kind of connected in the back. So if people know Hell's Kitchen, they know that many of the spaces along the avenues are kind of these narrow, about 9 feet wide, 10 feet wide, and 40 to 60 feet long. These spaces where everybody does business, and we got two of those next to each other, and we're luckily able to connect them in the back together. So the northern side, it's on the east side of 10th Avenue, and the northern side is our wine bar and the open kitchen, and then the southern side is our dining room. And we're going to be focusing on certainly be farm-to-table inspired, and we'll be focusing on small plates and large plates. So we start with bites. Those are all vegan, and those are just bar bites like shallot fried potatoes, house roasted mixed nuts, pickled market vegetables, portobello mushroom, quote-unquote bacon, and farmer's market pretzels with a local black mustard. And those are, we're trying to keep everything very, very price-friendly. And the ambiance at Diane Elizabeth is going to be a little more refined than the ambiance at the Marshall. The Marshall is a very kind of rustic raw wood. A lot of people compare it almost to something they would see in the East Village or in Williamsburg. It's a little out of place mm-hmm. in Hell's Kitchen, which I think for us is a strength. But with Diane Elizabeth, we decided to give a decidedly more upmarket feel to the ambiance without doing that to the prices. And then, so our large and small plates, you know how if you go to a wine bar with four or five friends, you have to order like 10 things so everybody can get a bite. And I didn't want to do that. That always annoys me. And so what we're doing is we have 16 items on the menu on the main plates, aside from those bites. And everything will be available at the same price. So you'll be able to get a small or a large of anything for 12 for a regular portion, 18 for a double-sized portion. And it's going to be very fun. And we've named all the dishes as if they were cocktails, trying to be very kind of punchy.
Who's Diane and Elizabeth?
Well, Diane is my business partner's mother, and Elizabeth is my mother.
Lovely. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it is. It's, giving credit where credit's due.
Uh-huh. That's really sweet.
Yeah, it is. I learned to cook from, I didn't go to culinary school, I learned to cook from my mother, and from what we had around, and so you learn to be creative, and you learn that, you know, rules are sometimes made to be broken or sometimes made to not be understood, which is
mm-hmm.
the case. Sometimes I don't know if something's technically wrong when I do it, but it's still delicious.
Right. Well, I didn't go to culinary school either, and I learned to cook as defense for my mother's cooking. My mother doesn't get the credit. When I first got my wok, and I know people who listen to me have heard this story many times, but I opened a can of veg oil, like mixed vegetables, and put that into my wok. That's all I knew about vegetables.
Growing up
on Long Island. I never had a fresh vegetable in my house other than iceberg lettuce and the makings of, you know, an iceberg lettuce salad. So anyway, I am self-taught too, but I had to, you know, go out, become a vegetarian, and then go seek good food.
That's a much harder road than I experienced.
Or just a different one. But anyway, still exciting. And I think one of the things that's beautiful that you and I share is to be able to share our love of cooking with people and let them know that anything we do, they can do. It's not rocket science, you know. It's not.
And people are eating out of boxes. It's an epidemic. especially in the city. People come home and they're tired from work and they sit down and they go on to one of these delivery things and they order delivery. And I mean, the Marshall delivers. By all means, I encourage everyone to eat out of a box from the Marshall. But at the same time, you know, cooking is a very valuable skill, and the fussier eaters become, the more they should consider cooking, because you can make something just how you like it, and it's not difficult. You know, you may not have a 600-degree wood oven at the Marshall, but I can make anything that I make at the Marshall at home. And the same thing with Diane Elizabeth. There are a few rules to using, I think, local, tasty ingredients. One is let yourself taste the ingredient. And if you use too much seasoning or you use too many different things, you have too much going on, the purity of what you've got gets lost. And then as restaurateur, you know, my other rule is 3 colors on every plate.
mm-hmm.
And the plate doesn't count as a color. And so with Diane and Elizabeth, for instance, you know, really most of the dishes that we'll be doing have anywhere from 3 to 5 elements, and that's it. We want people to taste the depth of local ricotta. We want them to taste the sage and the brown butter. We want them to taste the pine smoke and the smoked mascarpone, and that's it. You want them to taste these elements together, and you don't need to have, you know, 35 ingredients and just, you know, chef something to death in order for people to enjoy it. And I think that makes cooking a lot less intimidating for the common folk, you know. And it's okay to screw up, too. Usually screwing up is still good, you know, and I
you
screw
learn
up all
from
the time.
It. Uh-huh.
And if you don't screw up, you're not learning anything.
Right. It's good. Those are good lessons, absolutely. You know, one thing you've talked about a few times, and I'd like to just touch on, is taste. I think our taste buds in America, we've become so our level of expectation is so low, and I don't think we even realize it. You know, I mean, people see a beautiful-looking strawberry, and they eat it and go, oh, it's so good, and then I'll take one, and I'm going, no, it's not. It's, you know, it's cold, and it might be juicy, but it doesn't taste like a strawberry at all. It just tastes sour, and, you know, and I think so often we've gotten used to foods not having so much flavor.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, that is, you know,
the industrial
that we really fight against it at the Marshall. It's, you know, and like I said, you know, we cheat. We use good ingredients. You know, everybody else has to add a bunch of sugar and oil and fat and salt.
People talk about food tasting so good when they go to Italy, and it's like, why? I make the same thing at home. It doesn't taste the same. Like, because you're not using the same quality of ingredients.
Yeah, exactly. And people don't, I think, often realize how industrial some of these industrial farms are. I don't think people understand that if they're eating a potato that's not an organic potato or from a local farmer, you know, that's practicing organic or near to it, that they're literally eating a potato that instead of cutting the tops off now, they just spray them with herbicide. And the farmer can't go out in that field for 2 weeks afterward because it's so poisonous. But your potato that you're going to eat is sitting in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put them in a barn to air out after they dig them. And then they can't go in that barn for a week or 10 days because the air is so toxic from the things that they're spraying on these potatoes to kill the potato greens, to kill fungus, to kill all these things, because we want this perfectly white potato with no brown in it when you cut it open and all these things. And, you know, some people say, ew, there's a little, you know, brown something inside my potato. And I say, ew, there's no brown something inside my potato. I'd much rather have that. So if
right.
you eat potato chips and they don't say organic, that's most likely what you're eating, is something that's been sitting in that. But, you know, I love to make potato chips. I love to. And I make them out of, you know, local potatoes that we get at the farmer's market. Or I buy organic potatoes, potato chips, which are very, very, very hard to find. Most
mm-hmm.
potato chips, even local potato chips, are not organic.
Right.
And, you know, for something that's sitting in the ground and really soaking up everything that is, you know, sprayed on it and sitting there for 2 weeks after they spray it, it's something people should be really, really careful with. But also, potatoes have a lot more flavor than people understand. We get potatoes from a place called Buried Treasures Farm, and she does berries and potatoes and a few other things. And she has these varieties from all around. She travels the world and smuggles potatoes back and grows them. And it takes her sometimes 5 or 6 years before she has enough that she can start selling them. But these purple Peruvian potatoes that are super high in protein and have this wonderful nutty flavor. Ozettes, which almost look like a sunchoke or a Jerusalem artichoke elongated because they're so variegated on the outside. And what's that do? It holds your seasoning in really well, these little bumps and everything. We roast those and serve them as roasted fingerlings. But this sort of approach, the ingredient-centered approach, is a much healthier approach. If you find good, flavorful food that was grown correctly, it's you don't have to do nearly as much work, and
right.
you end up with something that tastes
uh-huh.
like it should. And if you don't know, or you think you know what things should taste like, go to the farmer's market. They'll let you eat a strawberry, and you'll see the difference.
Uh-huh. I know we've talked before. I wanted to ask you to share with my listeners your favorite home kitchen trick.
Ah, my favorite home kitchen trick. Well, it's one of thrift, and that's having a mirepoix bag in my freezer. And there's nothing wrong with freezing carrots or onions or whatever. So if I use 2/3 of an onion, or, you know, because I've got a big onion and the recipe calls for one onion, and I know one is too much, like if I were making your watermelon salad,
mm-hmm.
go ahead and throw the rest of the onion that I know I'm not going to use the next day or two right into my mirepoix bag. If I'm using a carrot, I'll throw the ends of the carrot into, and sometimes I cut them a little bigger because I know that I want to save a little something for my mirepoix bag. But then next time I'm going to make soup, there I have all my vegetables in my freezer, and I'm not terribly picky. I'm not making a in-stone mirepoix. It's a, you know, whatever I've got for scraps that's going to make a nice soup.
Uh-huh.
And then, lo and behold, soon enough, I've got my mirepoix bag, and it's all ready to go, and I can just throw it in and start my stock. So I love that idea, and it's something that if you're in New York with a small kitchen like I have, you don't always have a bunch of celery and a bunch of carrots and a bag of onions, and you just don't have room for it all. So having this where you keep your scraps in the freezer makes for having a kind of a richer repertoire when you're ready to.
I love that idea. I'm going to steal it, because what I end up doing is I end up, you know, feeling too guilty when I have all these, like if I'm doing a job and I have all these stresses, like, I got to make a stock. I can't just, you know, even
yeah.
though I compost everything, you know, I need to turn it into a stock first. I make a stock, but then I have to freeze all this stock, and I don't have enough freezer space.
Right.
For
exactly.
The stock.
Well, now you don't have to. You could just freeze the mirepoix and then make the stock when it's time to make the stock.
Oh, I love that idea. Thank you.
Yeah, you're very
Thank
welcome.
You. Okay, so then why don't you share one of your favorite little kitchen items that you have, you know, little appliance
My favorite
or...
favorite kitchen items. Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I'm probably speaking to the choir here, but you know, most people, and this might sound a little obvious, don't have a decent knife.
Oh my God! I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, but I go to my friend's house to cook or help them, whatever they're making dinner, and you're trying to slice a tomato with a dull, serrated paring knife. I mean, come on. If you don't know how valuable a good knife is, go buy one, and you will understand how valuable it is. And now they have these wonderful ceramic knives that you can buy. They're not, you know, you can even drop it in your sink. It's not going to break. And they almost, you know, don't lose their edge at all because they're so hard. And they're very inexpensive. And you can get them at Bed Bath & Beyond or Williams-Sonoma. And they're much less expensive than something that, you know, a chef like me would want to have in their kitchen. And it serves the purpose. And it gives you a good knife. And you don't have to know how to sharpen it. I think a lot of people are intimidated by a nice knife because they don't want to have to know how to sharpen it. If you buy a nice ceramic knife, you can get a little paring knife and you can get a nice big chef's knife, and you'll have almost everything you need, you know, to do basic cooking. Aside from that, one of my favorite things that I recently got was an old-fashioned whipper, and it's one of those old whisks that they just don't make anymore that I got at a secondhand store. And with a whip or a whisk, they're very...
You mean the thing that has a little crank on it that you turn?
No, it's like a handle with a triangular piece of metal that comes off of it, and then a spiral of metal all the way around it, like a curly Q all the way around.
Oh, I see. Okay,
Yeah,
it's like a whip.
You know, but you don't know where or why or how long. And they're so great because you can with a whisk where it will drag through something thick. Instead of, you know, and you then flip out at the end, is like, you know, if you can imagine quickly dragging a whip through a pancake batter or something, has kind of goes all over the place after it comes out. This has some body to it, but it still gives you the ability to whip. And I love old kitchen tools. And if you go to the Goodwill or a secondhand store, you can find things that no one else has that are really useful. And the only reason they don't make them anymore is because people don't cook as much as they used to. And they probably don't sell enough of them. And they don't have those, you know, big, weird plastic handles that everything they sell has now. They've got a beautiful, you know, enameled wood handle, and I like the romance behind it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
yeah, I have one of those little hand crank mixers. That's what I thought you were talking about.
Oh,
you know?
Those are great. I don't have one of those. I don't have one of those, but I do have a KitchenAid, and if I were to use it, I'd probably use my KitchenAid or just use a hand whisk, but I do love those. But my parents had one when I was a kid, and I think I'd find all kinds of reasons to use it.
Right.
Because they are really fun.
Wow, this has been wonderful. So when is Diane and Elizabeth's going to open?
We are hoping that we'll be open in about a month. It really just depends, you know, was you know, everybody who's ever done anything ever.
Construction. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the restaurant's finished. Right now we're waiting for power from Con Edison. Con Edison, if you're listening, please bring me electricity. But,
well, make sure to let me know, and then I will let everybody, all of my listeners and newsletter people know on my newsletter, okay?
Thank you so much. But in the meantime, Marshall is open for business, so everybody can try that out.
Why don't you share with everybody where it is before we...
Yes, it's on 10th Avenue between 44th and 45th Streets, and we're pretty close to a lot of the Broadway theaters, so it is a great place to go if you're going to a show. You can hit us beforehand for pre-theater dinner.
And make a reservation, because it is small.
It is tiny. It's my first restaurant, and all I could afford was a hallway with tables in it, so it literally seats 26 people, and we do fill up pretty close to 7 days a week. So it's at least for pre-theater, it's very important to make a reservation. But you can do it online.
That's great. Thank you, Charlie. Everybody listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now, and have a great rest of the week, and come out to our summer solstice celebration. Bye for now.